isn't this moment what matters the most? And honey, isn't this moment what matters the most?
Welcome to This Hour Has 50 Minutes, where two therapists talk more than they listen. I'm your host, Dr. Tamara Souls. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 58 of This Hour Has 50 Minutes. Today I'm talking about understanding childhood alarm with one of my favorite guests, one of my favorite psychologists, and one of my favorite all-around human beings, Ashley Warner. But before we get into Ashley's episode, some of you may have already heard the update that I released recently, sharing the news that after a lot of consideration, I have decided to end the podcast. There will be one more episode released after this one, so 59 episodes. It was not an easy decision to make. You can listen to that mini update for more information. But I truly have loved every second of these conversations and bringing this to other therapists out there. I value the feedback that I've gotten and the engagement from all of you listeners. And every time I look at the episode stats and see how many different countries this podcast has been listened in, I am truly floored, overwhelmed, and grateful. It is sad for me to let this project go, even though I have enjoyed it so much, and it has also allowed me to have a type of diversity in my career that I have been needing and wanting. But I also have to recognize that at this stage of where I'm at, personally and professionally, I need to pivot. So I want to just take a moment to thank all of you and to thank all of my guests for participating in this and, again, for all the feedback and all the listeners. So thank you. If you haven't heard my mini update, go ahead and check that out. But now I want to dive in to Ashley's incredible episode. Ashley is a mom, a woman, a gentle parenting advocate, and a passionate holistic family psychologist. Her mission is to spread the message that as we move onto the path of parenthood, healing becomes one of our greatest responsibilities. And there's no one better to lead you on that journey than Ashley. You should definitely check out her membership, The Kind Collective, that adds so much value to this parenting journey. And there's a lot of great workshops on her site. So be sure to check out her site, linked in the show notes. Let's get started. Ashley, I am always excited to talk to you, and I just love everything you put out in the world. I'm grateful that you exist for parents and for professionals like myself, because I'm always learning from you, and I have no doubt I will be today too. So thank you for being here with me and having this conversation.
Thank you for having me, Tamara. It's always great to talk to you as well. And I'm really looking forward to sharing this conversation with you.
Why don't we start by having you share a little bit about yourself, your work, and the things that kind of light you up in your life right now?
So I'm a family psychologist, and I work predominantly online with families of kids who they kind of identify as being stuck or sensitive, and basically with parents who are feeling stuck and having a really hard time. I think that we have, you know, we're moving towards this more respectful approach to parenting and managing and supporting children. But often when things get really hard, we kind of resort back to those traditional ways or those more behaviorist kind of responses because they feel so familiar and therefore safe. And so my kind of biggest passion is really how do we get these really deeper core challenges in families and still find that respectful attachment-based way of moving through that rather than, going back to what we used to do.
I love that you said that, because even myself as a parent and a psychologist, I find that if I'm extra vulnerable for any particular reason, I'm sick, I'm tired, there's a lot going on, that my default will also kind of revert to these behavioral things that are not how I parent in general, and certainly not the approach I take. But as you say, it's almost like this safe, you know, it's this imprinting of the experiences that we've had that we shift back to. So I'm certainly not even immune to it, even in my own.
Neither. And I know as a psychologist as well, there is that sometimes I feel the pullback and I have to really ground in the trust and knowing of what I do. And I do, I feel that pull sometimes of like, oh, maybe we should just go back to this behavior modification because, you know, at least it's been around for a long time.
Exactly.
Not that it actually has in real history, but if we're talking about, you know, our own experience as professionals. But yeah, I think that that's when we can all feel wobbly. And that's what I really feel like is my kind of mission in this space is to support us to stand strong in our values, even when it feels really hard and unfamiliar.
Exactly. So today, what I want to talk to you more about is anxiety in children and what developmentally appropriate interventions should look like. So I thought maybe we could start with just some terminology, because I know that you often speak about alarm in children. And so I wanted to highlight that and have you share a little bit about why the word alarm, why do you choose that, and what is the distinction for you, and how do you explain using alarm when you're talking about anxiety?
Yeah, so I actually first heard this off Dr. Gordon Neufeld, and he's the one that kind of, I think, has shifted this in the space. And it just resonated so much with me as soon as I heard it, because it is that more biological representation of what's happening in a child's body. So the child is feeling alarmed. And when we just use the word alarm, I think that we get this like more softness and more empathy and understanding. There's something about anxiety that feels wrong or feels like we need to fix it or we need to stop it. And I think it kind of gives us anxiety to think about the word our kid has anxiety versus that more biologically accurate term around my child's system is alarmed. My child is feeling alarmed. And then what do we need to do for that? And I think it just creates more of a caring and compassionate and grounded kind of response with that language that we use. So funnily enough, now everybody uses that word around me, like that my parents have just really adopted it. And wow. I think that in itself, when the parents you work with and your clients start to use that language, you know, it really lands.
You're right about that softness. And I think it is far less pathologizing to talk about alarm than anxiety, right? And even if parents are using the label, like I have an anxious child, there is a connotation to that for many people, and including for parents, that might make them feel a whole host of feelings, which of course then translates into how they respond when their child is alarmed. And so I agree that there is that softness. And as you said, it's a better biological representation. And I also think that it is a better descriptor for many situations that cause a child to be alarmed that aren't necessarily what some might consider to be anxiety, right? So there's many very valid reasons why our nervous systems are in a state of alarm, and that's not anxiety. But when we have that term to describe that physiological state and that nervous system state, it, I think, grounds us in that biological reality. So I really like how you described that.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Let's dive right into some of the challenges and problems with how this is addressed clinically for many families. So we know that CBT tends to be the treatment model of choice, and I understand where that comes from. And certainly, having supervised many clinicians, and having been at one time many years ago an early clinician myself, and you are finding your way and knowing that this research supports CBT as the effective treatment, and knowing that here you have this manual that you can follow, and that makes it much more, it seems easier in a way as a clinician to feel like, okay, I have this approach and this approach works, and I just need to apply it to this child. And it almost doesn't even matter what they're anxious about because this is the model. So where does that go wrong for you? Tell me a little bit more about your thoughts for CBT in kids in particular.
Yeah. So, you know, I too used it for many, many years, and it's very much in Australia the model of choice for primary school age children. And it's the way our system is literally designed for it, because our government will provide rebates to psychologists for 10 sessions, which is essentially to set you up to do that 10-week model of CBT. So it's very much guided in our profession as the way to work. And I think what I found was that it just put way too much responsibility on young children. And, you know, if you think about as an adult what it means to really look at your thoughts and to challenge your thoughts and to do that mindset work, and you imagine that as an 8-year-old kid who's already alarmed and already feeling like maybe there's something wrong with you, and then they have to go to a session on Wednesday afternoon after school and they're already exhausted, and then they go, okay. And I just noticed that so many of the kids I was working with took that pressure on, that this is my job. I need to fix my thoughts. There's something wrong with me, and there's something wrong with what's happening in my body, and I need to change that. And I'm the one that has to fix it, because I'm going to this person. And you know, as much as we try and do it with play, and as much as we try and do it with so much empathy and compassion, I think that these kids who are geared towards alarm are much more likely to interpret that as, there is something wrong with me and it's my job to fix it. And that's what I just kept seeing. And I just was concerned about. They need to be able to relax into their play. They need to be able to relax into their relationships. They need to be able to let their parents take charge. And I'm not sure that this model, in the way that I've seen it work and the way that I was using it, I'm sure everybody has different perspectives and understandings. You know, like we know from the research, what do they say about the models of psychology that work, of therapy that work the best, are actually how much you believe them yourself, right? Exactly. So
yeah,
there's so much out there. So this is just from my perspective and my own experience. But yeah, I found that I was working with a lot of these, you know, little kids who were already feeling alarmed and already taking on too much responsibility, and it seemed to make that worse.
Yes. I think that's such an important perspective, this notion of responsibility. And I think that I would agree with you, having worked in both Canada and the US as a whole, that model is the model of choice in both places, most more generally. And also this notion of working with kids where we take children into a room by themselves and then bring in the parent for the last 10 minutes and summarize all this amazing therapy work we've done in a few minutes with the parent and send them along their way. And it just seems so backward. Mm-hmm. Like, if anyone should be coming in for the last 10 minutes, it's probably the child, not the parent, right? So it just seemed like systemically our approach is set up to not be hitting the root and laying the work where the work belongs. And I say that with zero blame. It's just the practicality of where the work should be done. It's not the source of the problem. It's just where the work should be done. And so we, I think, suffer from that same model as well.
It can be our responsibility without it being our fault.
Exactly.
Right. Like, I think that's really important as parents. Like, we can have to take the responsibility on. It doesn't mean we take the blame and the shame on. Like, yes, they're very different things.
Yes, exactly.
So I think when we're talking about parenting work, that's just really important to clarify.
Yes, because we as parents can be the mechanism for change. Mm-hmm. And that is much more powerful than I'm going to be as the therapist in the room, right? And for me, that's why many years ago, I have primarily switched to working almost exclusively with parents, despite, you know, whatever the reason for referral is, because that is where I see the most change happen and where we're most effective. So for me, again, part of that is our own belief and how we feel effective. But I can say for myself and for my work, that's really where I'm like, I feel this movement, I feel this, you know, change. And I think, yeah, there could be all kinds of reasons for it. But for me, that's where I settled into my comfort as a clinician most, was in that realm, because I think I felt many similar experiences to what you described when working with children. And it's not that we didn't see gains, and we did, but there was something about that process that felt off or felt challenging, or there'd be these stuck points along the way. And you feel like you're going through the motions of describing these sticky thoughts, or however we wanted to frame them in a child-friendly way. But for them to be able to actually reflect on these thoughts and then act on them, aren't we asking most of them to do something that they're not actually developmentally capable of? What are your thoughts about that piece of it?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I think that the level of cognitive awareness and functioning in the brain that's required to be able to carry out something like that, to recognize your thoughts. And, you know, we're like, I think the research, there's lots of different theories and ideas about this, but it's not so clear cut that like our thoughts create our emotions, right? Like it's very bi-directional. And so, you know, some people will say it depends on the emotion that then leads to the thoughts, and the thoughts are just making sense of the emotion. And so it's just a very complex system. And I think that the capacity for children to understand that thought and then shift or change or work on that thought is far beyond what I think we should be expecting of them. And I'd much prefer to see them learning how to be with that emotion and accept that emotion and not think that that emotion's actually wrong. And sometimes that means we can do some work around the thoughts, but really it's that much more acceptance and riding that emotion out that I think that they are more capable of and is a much more appropriate kind of work.
Yeah. And I find in both my professional life and even in my personal life, I find that where the cognitions can be more effective, or the way that I think about them perhaps, is like seeds that the parents can plant through their own modeling, right? So they can learn about them and they can start to describe them when they find themselves in that situation. And so have that exposure and that teaching, as opposed to me sitting with a worksheet with them and, you know, engaging in these conversations about these negative automatic thoughts or whatever we're calling them. At least that way, it becomes a part of the vernacular of a family where we're catching our thoughts and we're noticing our thoughts and the connection, as you say, a multi-directional connection between our thoughts, our feelings, our behavior. And it just becomes a part of the fabric of how we move through the day and how we talk and how we think, without it necessarily being like, okay, this week, this is what we're focusing on. And I expect now that you're going to be catching those thoughts. I'm going to ask you what thoughts you caught and how you shifted them and what miraculous change you had the minute that you thought that. So for me, that's how I have tried to integrate that piece of it, both into my professional life and my personal life.
And I love that, because that's the parent walking the walk. And then there's just this modeling and this, like you said, it's just in the home. And so then you don't have the layer of pressure. So the child then is much more receptive and much more open to learning. And they're likely to pick that up because they're watching their attachment figure, who we know they want to be the same as, and they want to be like them. And they're seeing that this is how it's done in different aspects of their day. And I think that that just allows them to learn those same ideas, but without adding responsibility, which is only going to add more alarm and distress.
Right. And as you said, you know, the goal is not to remove alarm from, you know, a child's system that's not safe. We need that. It serves a function. And so being able to shift this away from thinking that I'm bringing an anxious child for 10 weeks, and by the end of those 10 weeks, I'm not going to have an anxious child, is just setting everyone up, I think, for failure in pretty big ways. Of course, CBT has its merits in certain contexts and can be useful in certain contexts, but I definitely share the same view as you, and those experiences have certainly been mine as well clinically. Are there other treatment approaches that you find are commonly used with anxiety in children or children who are alarmed that you find also are not necessarily developmentally appropriate or aren't factoring in this biological reality?
I guess what concerns me most is not even necessarily the types of therapies we use, but are we looking at the environment that the child is in and why the child's feeling alarmed? And sometimes that most developmentally appropriate response would be to shift the environment or to try and make the environment more developmentally appropriate. So I think often we're thinking about the intervention. And so we're thinking about what's the therapy I can use instead of actually just coming back to the basics of, if we think about, you know, a flower in the garden, what do we do when that flower isn't thriving? We shift it into more or less sunlight, or we build a little shelter over it. And so I think sometimes we have to actually come back to the basics of what's actually causing this alarm. And are there situations in this child's week where they're just actually not developmentally appropriate? And do we need to adjust that before we focus on more therapies and ideas? So I guess what I think, and I think that's the key piece that many clinicians are struggling to really advocate for. And because I think that's the really hard piece, right? It's a lot easier. Let's be honest, it's a lot easier to send a kid to therapy once a week on a Wednesday afternoon, or as the clinician to do a 1-hour session with a child, than it is to go, let's throw everything up in the air. What's actually happening here? We live in a society where we know that many of the expectations we place on our children are not developmentally appropriate. And so how can we be honest about that? And how can we really come back to talking about maybe there are some things that need to shift so that this child can thrive, and so this child is actually experiencing less alarm. And then with the alarm that's, you know, normal and left over, and well, they're all normal, but you know what I mean? With the yeah. less, if they have to manage less alarm, then are we seeing less symptoms?
Yes. Yes. I'm so glad that you've taken it in this direction, because this is really one of the aspects I wanted to talk to you about, because I think that there are so many aspects of our various cultures that are setting kids up to be alarmed. And certainly there are some kids for whom those situations are not as alarming, be it for temperamental reasons, other contextual reasons. But for many, some of the things that many of our members of society feel are the typical trajectory, be it sleeping in a crib independently, be it daycare, be it how the school system works, be it, you know, after school activities, sleepovers, sleepaway camps, whatever it may be, all of these expectations that are often deemed to be a so-called typical part of childhood can be very alarming. And in many ways, for many children, are not developmentally appropriate, and they're not developmentally ready for that. So I'm glad that you brought this up. So tell us a little bit more about that, if you can, just to expand on this notion of fit and how we may be, again, creating more problems or really just missing the mark if we're not willing to be brave enough as clinicians to kind of bring that up. And I say brave because there can often be a lot that is very sensitive about that topic to bring up to families, because there may be a lot of financial constraints, logistical constraints, a lot of mindset work. There's so many elements of that. And as a clinician, as you said, it's much easier to just say therapy once a week, we can tackle this. But to say, let's actually look if they're ready to be away from you, or let's actually look if they can handle this environment, that's a big thing to bring up to a parent. So tell me a little bit more about your thoughts and approach there.
Yeah, and it is really hard. And I have such compassion for every single parent in this modern world, because we are in this challenging experience where we're parenting kids in a society that's literally not designed in alignment with what we know about development. And so we're constantly pushing up against these challenges. And I think that's why it is, as you said, that's why it takes a lot of bravery as the clinician to actually say, you know what? This is really tough, but actually this situation, this is what they're not handling. This is where the alarm is. Let's take, for example, preschool. So in Australia, we've just increased the amount of preschool to up to a huge, huge amount, 30 hours a week for children to be in preschool. And, you know, parents are pulled into, okay, well, that's what's being said is best. Therefore, I need to get my kid in that system, because that's what is going to get them to be on that trajectory of being okay. And And my work really is to help parents flip that and go, just because they're not ready today on their third birthday or their fourth birthday, like the system says they should, doesn't mean they're not going to be ready. And actually sometimes pulling back and sometimes thinking outside of the box about how can we shift that is the intervention. And that's the work. But it is, it's really complex because parents can take it personally. They can feel like they've done something wrong. And so it's always a delicate dance of how do we get this message out there without parents feeling blamed or shamed, because that's not the intention. We're just working with a society that just doesn't get it and a yeah. society that has different needs, right? If we're looking at the society as a whole, it's not necessarily focusing on children's developmental needs.
There's also, I find, for many parents, if they don't choose to follow that path that society has outlined or has created, or alternatively, if they recognize that that fit isn't working for their child and they make that change, they often get a lot of feedback mm-hmm. from other people that makes it really hard, right? Like why, if your child isn't, and we could insert any of those developmental things that I mentioned before, if your child isn't mm-hmm. sleeping alone, if they aren't going to preschool, if they're not participating in after school activities, they're going to miss out on X, Y, and the Z thing. And they're getting this message from many people around them that is maybe contradictory to what they're coming to learn about what their child needs. And so again, there's bravery on the parts of the parents to be able to say, my child may need something different. And again, that may work well for your child, even if we might think developmentally these things are not generally how development unfolds, but some kids are go with the flow enough that they can navigate it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it isn't right for, you know, all kids. Or
one of my clients was actually telling me the other day that from working with me, she said, I just had to shift my marker of success. It mm-hmm. used to be, is my child sleeping alone? Is my child going to school every day? Is this happening? And then she said, I realized it was much more about how vulnerable they are, how much they're willing to lean into connection. Are they crying? Are they playing? Are they mm-hmm. like all of these basic things? And she said, when I could start to shift that and then I could see my child for who she was and what she needed, and then I could adjust. And I think that that's often the intervention is we have to shift what we see as markers of success.
Yeah.
And then our child will give us the information that yeah. we need to go, actually, my child is totally fine in this situation, even though it's not developmentally appropriate, and not second guess that.
Yes. Yes. I love that. That's wonderful. So let's talk about what you find does work. So you've kind of hinted at some of these things, and obviously one of the primary ones being, let's look at this garden, right? Let's see what's going on there. And thankfully, I'm a better psychologist than gardener, but let's, you know, look at this.
It's a very bad analogy for me to use.
I mean, I'm sure it's great for some other people, not for me. But, you know, so that's obviously one of the major ones. We have to kind of be willing to throw everything out and start from scratch and really see what helps this child feel safe and connected. But what are some of the approaches that you think about, knowing you and knowing your work? I know some of the things that you really value in terms of helping children release this alarm for their bodies and how they can move through it. So talk me through some of the things that you feel are key in helping parents support their child and learn how to help them when they're alarmed.
So I guess what I come back to is really just getting those foundations and those basic natural processes that exist in order to release energy out of our system. And so I will support parents in order to support the child. So my work is no longer with children, for kind of as we talked about in the start. And so my work is really just around supporting the parents to understand what I call kind of the three R's. So reduce, release, and take responsibility. And so where can we reduce? So that child just isn't having to hold so much, because that can have huge, huge impacts, as we talked about. And then how can we get them throughout their day releasing that emotion out of their body through things like their self-directed play, through things like having their tears, crying, having a big release when there's been things in their life that they can't control, things like movement to the point of fatigue. Like I know, I remember when I used to talk about this, I used to just point it out as movement. Your child's body needs to move. And then I realized, oh no, parents are missing this. It needs to be to the point of fatigue. Like the child needs to be able to move their body to the point that they're tired. And if kids are sitting in desks all day, and unfortunately that's the reality for a lot of our kids, that's not necessarily happening. And so we need to make sure that we're intertwining. We're weaving that into our everyday life with our kids, because these are the natural things that will actually help them shift the emotion. And I was working with a little girl recently, actually, or a mum of a little girl who had done a lot of CBT before she came to see me. And so we really worked on reversing that responsibility, because she was that very typical alarmed child. Family had separated, mum was a single mum. So she naturally took on that, I'm going to take responsibility for everything, including my alarm. And so we did a bit of work to undo that. And then her mum was telling me that she was telling one of their family friends, and she said, yeah, when my butterflies come into my tummy, I just know I need to give mum a hug. I need to have a cry. I need to play, or I need to dance. It's one of those things. And then they just start to go away. And I thought, that simplicity. Wow. And no pressure, right? Like it's not, yeah, I have to fix them. It's just, oh, one of these things is going to make them feel less intense.
Yeah.
And so I think working with parents so that they deeply understand that and they can weave that into conversation and naturally without the child feeling pressure, but the parents just got this wisdom and the child just looks up to them to go, oh, that worked. Tell me more. And then that child feels really trusting of that parent. And I think that this is one of the things that I love most about the parent approach, is because the next time that child has a hard time, they're going to go to their parent because they remember that their parent just knew stuff and they don't know that I'm in the background talking to their parent. They don't have to know that. They just know, wow, my mum knows stuff. My mum gets it.
Yes.
And that for me is what really transforms families, because it just puts puts that parent in that position where they're the one that knows stuff. And that's really important.
It really is. And I think coming back to Neufeld's approach too, right? And there's lots of nuance here that we don't need to go into today. I have a lot of feelings about his work, many of which are wonderful feelings. But in particular, this notion of the parent being the I've got this parent, right? So however we want to refer to it, the alpha parent, as he may talk about it. But really, in this context, what resonates for me as a clinician is thinking about what you're saying, which is that the parent conveying this, I've got this. And I think that that's one of the very valuable things about doing parent work as opposed to working directly with the child, because as you said, the parent becomes the holder of that knowledge and they become the I've got this parent. And many times alarmed kids are living with alarmed parents. And when we are able to instill these ideas and empower with these interventions or strategies, it puts them in a position where they feel more calm, feel more able to come in service of their child and supporting their child. And ultimately, that's what we want, right? It's not about us and we shouldn't be center stage. It's really about empowering them. So that I've got this does kind of take that, you know, pressure, as you said so well earlier, take that pressure off the child, allow that to rest with the parent, but not flap the parent either. It's this, no, I've got this. And here are these things that we were trying, and how wonderful that you felt that, you know, that it shifted in some way, right? Not that we made anxiety go away, but that those butterflies shifted and it felt more tolerable. It felt more, you know, that we could kind of move through that.
And I think that's why, for me, it really is this, you know, I just gave one example of what I would support a parent to help a child understand. But always alongside that is I'm doing the deeper inner work with the parent around their own anxiety. Because there's like, it doesn't matter whether you had anxiety before your child did, whether they, you know, or it's just come up because now you're feeling, but we all have stuff.
Yep.
We all experience alarm. We all experience from time to time tricky thoughts. Like, that's just part of being human. And so when I can support a parent to walk that walk and really deeply understand their unconscious deeper desires, their fears, what, how that's playing out for them, then this magical thing happens where they start to translate that for their kid in a way that I never could. And they come up with these analogies and they come up with these stories. And when their child comes home alarmed or is alarmed before bedtime, they just know what to say because they've already walked the walk and they don't need to remember my scripts and they don't need to think about what would Ashley say. But there's this beautiful connection piece because in the background, I've given some ideas about what normally happens and what works for kids. But more importantly than that, we've done their deeper inner work. And that, I think, is far more powerful and lasting and sustainable than any other intervention that I've come across.
I'd like to take that even a step further because I think it's so key. And one of the biggest challenges I see in working with parents supporting alarmed kids is the fact that alarm is intense. It needs to be, right? It has to be, otherwise it wouldn't be effective. Yeah. But that is very depleting for many parents. And I would add to that, that alarm often looks like opposition in many kids. Mm-hmm. And for parents, even who are aware that this is what is happening, that this is alarm in my child, the intensity is so much and the need from the parent is so much. And especially when it's chronic and intense and daily, it is often hard for parents to be able to show up in the way that their alarmed child needs. So I suspect this is what connects to the inner work that you're talking about. But can you give some examples of how you might support a parent who's saying, I know what my child needs in that moment. I know they need my connection, but I don't feel like I can sit next to this bed one more night, or there's only so many times I can rock them when they're anxious and they need that movement. So what are some of the ways that you might support a parent who just feels depleted by the alarm of their child? Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So I guess what I'd be really curious about in those situations is like what's actually coming up for the parent. So the behavior is I feel too tired to do this, or I feel I don't have any capacity left to hold this. So what's going on that's deeper there? What are the deeper fears that are coming up that's making you just want to push away? That's making you just want to go, I just don't want to do this anymore, right? Because that level of like an out is telling us that there's something going on there. So what's that unconscious deeper fear? And then let's go into that. And so just last week, actually, I was having a conversation with a client who's dealing with exactly what we're talking about, really intense alarm in her children who had experienced some pretty significant trauma. And, you know, there's lots of stuff that comes up for her. But one of the things was shame, was really, which I think a lot of parents can feel is, why can't my kids go to school? What did I do wrong? Where did I go wrong? I had this perfect family. We were all going like this. And then they had some medical trauma. So things kind of, you know, went off track as we would expect. And the shame really is the piece for her. And so what we've been able to unpack is when that shame is driving the car, when that shame gets in control and starts making decisions, what do you do? And so we could really unpack the patterns that she does. And she says, that's when I feel like my kids have to go to school. Because mm-hmm. if they go to school, then I don't have to feel the shame, right? Ah, so now we're getting somewhere. So now we're getting to the deeper inner work of what that means and how with such, and I want to add here, she had, it was all to serve her children because she didn't want her children to feel the shame that she felt. So if she could just get them there, then they wouldn't have to feel the shame that she was so trying to avoid herself. And so when we can get to that, and then we can somatically move into that shame and feel it and realize that it doesn't get to be bigger than you. And I work with her on how to actually feel that in a way that's tolerable and helps the energy integrate into the nervous system, not just loop around. And then we get to do the work on that awareness of her patterns and the acceptance. And then the taking the action. And when we go through that, she has so much more capacity for her kids. So this was just an example of what we did last week. And then she left me a message on Monday and she's like, whoa, like, but she went in it, right? It was really hard. And she went in the tunnel of darkness and she felt it and she moved through it, but she was walking her walk of her own healing. And that is what gave her more capacity. So it wasn't a trick. It wasn't a like, let's do this or wasn't take away day. This pressure. It wasn't a spa day. There was no spa days, unfortunately, for my clients. I know I must hate that. We're far from spa days. And I was actually just laughing with her last week because I've got two clients who are friends. And she said, yeah, sometimes after our sessions, we ring each other and say, why does Ashley make me do this?
That's fantastic.
Because we go deep and that you yeah. think it's the opposite, right? You think my kid's already in this. I can't handle anything else. But actually, when we do our own inner work, it gives us the capacity. And it gives us more capacity. And then we're walking our walk. And so we get what our kid's going through and we get how to respond. And so, yeah, no spa days, no tricks, but just that really uncovering what's actually coming up for us and going there is the thing that I see gives my clients the most capacity to then hold more for their kids.
Feel the need to really underscore what you just said because it's so powerful and it is such a different way of thinking of it compared to how many people think about it. And I think social media, our culture in general, is inundated with these ideas, understandably and sometimes rightfully, about we can't pour from an empty cup. And so the notion is often if we lack capacity, it's because our cup is empty. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's that our cup is full, but it's full of shit. It's full of all kinds of stuff, right? And we need to think about what is filling that cup so that we can have that capacity back. And so I really want to highlight that because that is such a shift for a lot of people to think about the fact that when we can do that deeper, very difficult and personal work that we all have to do, right? That we all go through, regardless of our experiences, that's where the capacity comes from. So thank you for sharing that perspective and highlighting that. I want to ask you, you know, in your example, you gave things like movement to fatigue, you gave dancing, connection, tears. And I want to ask a couple of specific questions because I think that clinicians often use some similar strategies, but that may not be as effective as they are hoping that they would be. One of them comes to mind is deep breathing and sort of meditation and mindfulness for kids. And I've certainly used it in some capacities with certain kids. But tell me some of your thoughts about, are we extending this notion downward too far for kids who are maybe not developmentally capable, or that's not the right intervention for helping calm a nervous system?
Yeah. And I think that the reason where breathing and calming down strategies kind of tend to backfire is that you get these little kids who don't have the capacity to do it because it is an adult-based intervention. And what they're doing is they end up just holding it in. And they hold it in and they hold it in. I had this really powerful experience recently where I got to observe a little child who was being flagged as having some concerns and was heading down the process of a formalized assessment. And what I saw in this kid, because when I talked to the parents about, well, okay, well, what's being taught to this kid? Well, they have to do their breathing on their fingers and they have to take 5 deep breaths. And I can't remember, there was a couple of, and then they have to go away into a corner, into like a quiet corner at school. No, it was better. I'm doing air quotes for anyone who can't see me. But this is the thing, right? Like it is, they're telling people go away. Like there's a quiet corner and there's nice fairy lights. And sometimes, I'm not saying that doesn't always work. For some kids, they need it. And some kids, it really does work. But we have to be acutely aware of when a child is just using these things, but they're not actually doing them in the way that they're intended. And they're holding all of that emotion in. And so what I saw with this kid was he'd take himself away and he'd try and do a puzzle and I could see him holding it in. And then something else would happen. I could see him holding it in and he's trying to do his breathing. And then the next thing, and then he blew up. And so everybody looked at him and goes, well, he went from 0 to 10. I was like, he did not go from 0 to 10. Did you see the 5 times that he was holding it in and he was trying so hard to do what the adults in his life have asked him to do? He was trying, and he was only 4, and he was trying so hard, but he didn't have the capacity to breathe into regulation. And what he needed to do, and you could see him jumping on the couch, and then they'd say, stop jumping. So he'd hold it in, and he needed to move his body and he needed to get it out. And he needed somebody to say, I can see that your body needs to move. Let's go. And yeah. What would happen if we did that? And so sometimes I think that these interventions are based on very much, I would even say not even adult-based interventions, but almost like interventions of other cultures that work when that culture is already fairly regulated. Or places like Australia, I'm going to take as an example because I live here, we're not very regulated as a country, as a whole. There's a lot of dysregulation going on. And so then to add breathing is not necessarily where we're at. We've got a bit of work before we get there. And so there's a lot more movement and getting that emotion out and feeling the intensity before we try and do the slow breathing. And so I've gone on a bit of a tangent there, but I think breathing can work when a child's alarmed and they're having a panic attack, for example, really important.
Yep.
But to breathe to calm down frustration or to breathe to calm down something that we know when someone's taken your toy, I think that what unintentionally happens is kids hold it in and they don't actually shift and integrate the energy.
That was, again, beautifully said. And yes, you can certainly lump in North America into your general dysregulation. And that's absolutely right. When we have a culture that operates completely differently and, you know, maybe they spend the day in connection with their child or they spend the night in connection with their child or whatever the elements may be, their society is structured differently, their work hours,
any of it, right? Yeah.
But yes, though maybe that is an intervention that can be more effective with things like frustration, as you said. But I often, and I don't want to compare children to my old dog, but the example that I often give was the dog that we had for 14 wonderful years was so driven to chase squirrels. And if my dog saw a squirrel through our sliding glass door, he would, you know, scratch, 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 wanting to chase that squirrel. But there's this barrier of frustration, right? And so the squirrel goes away, but my dog doesn't go, oh, squirrel gone, right? Mm-hmm. He's activated now. And so that rests in his body. And then what I need to do is now throw the ball so that he can go chase that ball and bring it back to me and throw the ball and chase it and bring it back to me. So I use that example often because, number one, people like dogs often. And it's, you know, I find it's a very concrete way that parents can understand that agitation, that alarm, whatever word they're using to understand what's happening, is residing in the body still. And of course, it makes sense that for my dog, I'm going to throw a ball and go get it. I'm not going to sit with him and be like, squirrel's gone.
Sounds ridiculous when we put it in the animal world, doesn't it?
Of course.
No, it doesn't work.
But it doesn't work with the human either. No. And so, you know, we might not be throwing the ball, but that's pretty much the equivalent. They need to move to get that out. It needs to be released in some way. And sort of a deep breath in, deep breath out isn't necessarily releasing that agitation. It may send signals to calm that nervous system a bit in that state of panic, as you said, but in general, when we're angry or we're alarmed for different reasons, that's not necessarily where it's at. So that's just the example that I often use.
Beautiful. I love that. I'll have to borrow. I need my own dog for my own examples.
Just pretend. It's all good. It's all good. It's all good. Now, the other specific question I just wanted to ask you is, you talk about the release of tears, and this is something that I talk to families about often as well, is that tears being this natural release for kids. Now, some parents might say, so does that mean if I am having my child do something that makes them feel anxious, that the fact that they cry about it, is that what is relieving? So what would you say to that? Is that the kind of tears you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that that's one of the almost biggest unintentional misconceptions around this push towards accepting emotions, is that we're not understanding the different types of emotions and we're not understanding the different types of tears. And so a child who's alone in their bed crying is not releasing. There's alarm there, and their system is activated. And it's really important to start to understand the nuance of that, because a child who's disappointed because you said no to another TV show and they rest in your arms and they say, I really wanted it, and I just wanted one more and you said no, and they had a big cry. And example last night with my five-year-old who was really having a hard afternoon, and I just said, you know what, I think your body needs to go to bed early tonight. No, I don't want to go to bed early. And he wasn't alarmed. He was just like, no, don't make me, you will always make me go to bed. I know. And that was a release, right? He's disappointed. He's sad. He's upset. He's leaning into me. He's vulnerable. That's very different to, oh my gosh, you're leaving me alone, or I'm crying because I've seen a dog and I'm terrified of dogs. That's not a release. That's alarm. And the body is getting more and more activated. And that's when we need to act very differently from a child who's disappointed, they're sad, they can't change something, and they're leaning into us and they're having a big cry. And I think getting those is really important. And the other one that I always like to help parents understand too is when your child's really frustrated about something. So this didn't happen a lot with my eldest child, but it happens a lot with my second child, is he'll just get stuck on trying to change my mind. He's not releasing. He's just like, you know, the other day it happened where there was like, we made homemade icy poles and he wanted the pink one, but I didn't get the handle out properly. So it snapped. So the icy pole was stuck in the mold, no. But he's like, I want the pink one. I'm like, I get it, honey. Can you see it's not, but it wasn't a release. It was like this constant activation of, I am still trying to solve this problem and make it work. Yeah. And so my work was really to try and help him understand that wasn't going to happen. There was nothing he could do to change that. But I think understanding those different nuances is really key, because they do need a different response from us each time.
Ashley, you've given us so much wonderful wisdom today. I want to thank you for everything that you've shared. And I want to end by asking you the question that I ask all of my guests, which is whether there is a piece of advice that you remember that sticks out for you that you've received from a colleague or a mentor or a supervisor. Is there any nugget of wisdom that sticks out for you?
Yeah, I think probably the best or most important piece of advice, I can picture the person who gave it to me, was to do your own work, was to walk your own walk. And I think that it mirrors exactly what I want and what I encourage parents to do for their children, is walk your own walk of healing first. And I think that when we do that, then we can so deeply understand what our clients are going through and deeply support them on their own walk. And I don't think it was what I got in my training as a psychologist, but it was the piece of advice that has been so instrumental in actually knowing how to work with families, was needing to do my own inner work, understand my own alarm, understand my own thoughts. And that has been what's been enabled me to be able to help them through their walk.
I love that. That's wonderful. So Ashley, I know you have a tremendous amount of resources available to families. You have courses on anxiety, things that we talked about today. You have a membership. Where can people find you and find out more about the things that you offer?
Yeah, so my website is holisticfamilypsychologist.com, and that has all of my kind of workshops and information. And then I'm most active on Instagram, which is at @raisinghumanskind. So that's where you go.
Everybody needs to follow you on Instagram. The stuff you put out is just fantastic. Always amazing nuggets. And I, as I said at the top, so grateful for you and for what you do, what you put out into the world, and grateful for your time today. So thank you so much, Ashley, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Tamara. It's been a lovely conversation. Thank you.
I think our time is done for today, but I look forward to continuing this conversation next time.